This is the best of Central Coast Voices on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities, and it's provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Today on Central Coast Voices, we will highlight the realities of OCD to help break down stigmas and misconceptions. Join host Mario Espinoza-Kulik and guests Melissa Mose and Evelyn Demeglio-Gould from OCD Southern California to deepen your understanding and learn how to become part of the solution for those affected by OCD. We invite you to listen, learn, and participate in our conversation today on Thursday between 1 and 2. Unfortunately, we can't take your calls live today, but you can call them in to 805-549-8855, and we will pass them on to the panel. Or you can email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. And with that, let's join Mario and his guests. Over to you, Mario.
Good afternoon and welcome, everyone. My name is Mario Espinoza-Kulik, and you're listening to the Central Coast Voices on KCBX. We'll be discussing the experiences and perspectives of people living with obsessive-compulsive disorder, most commonly known as OCD. Together, we'll uncover the layers of OCD beyond the stereotypes and highlight the resilience of those battling this disorder. Today, we're joined by two guests, Melissa Mose, licensed marriage and family therapist, and the president of OCD Southern California. OCD Southern California is an affiliate of the International OCD Foundation. Evelyn Demeglio-Gould, licensed psychologist and board member of OCD SoCal. Welcome to Central Coast Voices.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
I'm so looking forward to this conversation with y'all. And I want to mention that our guests, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, email those to voices@kcbx.org. I want to begin by asking each of you to please share a little bit about your background and connection to today's topic. Melissa, do you want to start us off and share a little bit about your journey in the field of mental health and what led you to specialize in OCD?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been a licensed marriage and family therapist for almost 30 years at this point. And really, I never actually intended to be a therapist. I got interested in culture and people and through literature, but I became a therapist and I was really young at the time. So I specialized in working with teens and families and loved that. And then I have a daughter and one day when she was about 7 years old, she woke up with a sudden onset case of OCD. And even as a licensed mental health professional with a lot of experience, I had no idea how to help her. I tried everything we normally would try as good parents, as a therapist. I was really reassuring. I was as loving. I was as helpful as I could possibly be. And it just seemed to make it worse. So through her experience, and when she went to an outpatient program, it was an intensive outpatient program through UCLA, and she got better really quickly. I watched these therapists sit with her and do this very different kind of work than I'd ever seen before, called exposure and response prevention. And in about 3 weeks, I was seeing a difference. And I went from having a little 8-year-old girl who was terrified to eat food. And I can tell you more in a little bit about what those experiences were like for us as a family. But she was in a really dire place. And as she got better, I thought to myself, I want to learn how to do that. You know, talk therapy is wonderful. I've helped a lot of teenagers in their relationships with their parents, but that kind of help for people who are suffering to that extreme was something that I really wanted to dedicate my life to learning how to do. And so I went back and did all the training over again in the CBT field. I got involved with International OCD Foundation. I'm still very involved with our affiliate. And the last 15 years, I've really specialized in treating OCD. So most of my work, most of my clients now, either are family members of people with OCD or or individuals with OCD themselves. And I've started doing a lot of training and trying to help train clinicians because there isn't enough help out there for people who are suffering like that. So that's how I got involved, and that's what keeps me going is really knowing that even when you are fairly well informed in mental health, OCD is particularly challenging, and so it's a labor of love for me, for sure.
That's an amazing journey. Thanks for sharing with us, and also thanks for the service that you're providing to our community.
Thank you.
Evelyn, how about yourself? Want to tell us a little bit about how you got into this field and what led you to specialize in OCD?
Certainly. It's a long and winding road, so I'll try to summarize the highlights of that journey. But similar to Melissa, it's been a long one. But essentially, I got into the realm of mental health, I think, through my own personal experience as a young person who was really struggling. And I grew up, actually, I'm from Northern Ireland. I'm from Belfast. And grew up there, and there were not services there. There still are very minimal services in general for young people. And I was having a very hard time watching other people having a very hard time. So, and I didn't get good care. I did recover, and I'm doing great now. And but I really was looking for the opportunity to find a different way to see people who are struggling. And I had the fortunate experience of just wanting to go to America. When I finally went to university, I was like, I want to do a placement in America. I was studying psychology and I didn't really care what it was in. I just wanted to get out of Northern Ireland. But I lucked out in that I got to work in a clinic, in a pediatric clinic in Florida for 6 months. And I saw something very transformative happening there. I saw families coming into that clinic and leaving with hope and being viewed, never being viewed as broken or damaged, and being seen as whole humans and leaving with potential and just a sense of hopefulness about everybody can change. Everyone can be the best version of themselves with the right support and resourcing, and a very collaborative, wraparound, nurturing environment that I had not experienced or seen elsewhere. And I was very, very inspired just by the compassion and viewing people with the sense of your behavior makes sense when we look at your context and your culture and your biology and every part of you as a human being. We can understand what you're going through, and then we can help support you to live your life the way that you choose to live and the person you want to be and so on. And that hopefulness, when I had only experienced sort of a mental health system that had viewed people as broken or syndromes or things to be fixed, and that was very different for me. So that's what inspired me. I kind of went back to Ireland and thought, I want to be part of that. That's how do I be part of that? And through that journey, just by coincidence, ended up actually working more of the neurodiverse population. And that was where my first jobs were. And of course, there's very high co-occurrence of OCD and anxiety in the neurodiverse population, much higher than, say, in typically developing individuals. So people with autism, experiencing a lot of difficulties and mental health troubles that weren't really being addressed either by the autism services that I was in. And I also was very interested in looking at systemically looking at people, right, understanding people in context and the systems that they're part of. And I ended up kind of coming into OCD work because I was trying to figure out how to better support these families, not just the individuals that were struggling, but the families, and seeking out training and kind of certain kinds of approaches that would support the whole unit, the whole family, and looking at people more in context. And ended up actually then kind of moving sideways from autism into more OCD focused work because I was kind of looking to work with particular people, very, very talented, fantastic clinicians doing this kind of work, like Lisa Coyne, who works with families and young people. And I just fell in love with the resilience and the effectiveness, I think, just seeing the change and seeing the whole person kind of family based approach that Melissa, I guess, is going to tell us more from a personal perspective about. And that's kind of where I've been since. And I work a lot with neurodiverse individuals still, and also people. I'm a member of the queer community myself, so a lot of LGBTQIA plus mental health young people who also struggle a lot with OCD and anxiety. That's something I observe anyway. And so that's kind of where I am now, but still very much working with caregivers and the systems. And at work, I'm very interested in working in schools and how do we support young people in the education system and reach families more through different avenues of community outreach. And that, anyway, I could talk about that forever. That's kind of my journey. And I, yeah.
I appreciate you sharing your journey. I mean, what I gather from hearing both of you is that this is a really fulfilling field. There's lots of resilience that is experienced, I believe, on both sides, from the patient and the clinician. And what I wanted to kind of what that drew me to is to ask you, what do you tell somebody who is currently pursuing a career in this field, maybe specializing in OCD as well? What would you tell them to as they emerge into a practitioner?
You'll never be bored.
That's for sure. This is a fascinating field, and there's never you never stop learning, right? I think that because people are ever changing and emerging, and they're so complex. OCD is a particularly complex kind of pattern of thoughts and behaviors, and unique and very idiosyncratic, manifests differently, within certain parameters with different people. And there's various different types of OCD. So yeah, you'll never be bored, and it's so meaningful.
Humbling, I would say as well, if you are deeply meaningful, humbling, and if you're a curious person, that's a great curiosity space to be in, and compassionate and resilient space to be in.
Are there any common myths about OCD that you encounter in your work? And
Lots
how
of
do you
them.
respond?
Lots of them. That was the thing that was so amazing to me when I first encountered OCD. I wasn't really first encountered OCD with my daughter, but what I learned is that I had seen OCD in my practice and not recognized it as OCD until I was specifically trained, because it's not just washing and checking and flipping light switches and repeating things. OCD is a whole lot of other kinds of obsessions and compulsions that can include mental compulsions, meaning thinking things over and over or backwards or undoing things in thought ways. It's obsessions with content that doesn't really have to do with being a germaphobe or being complete or being perfect. It also, the idea that, oh, I have a little OCD. I heard this actually just yesterday from a professional in another field who asked what I do. And I said, I specialize with OCD. Oh, I think I have a little of that. It's great. And that is a misconception, because nobody really, from that perspective, I think our mainstream culture doesn't really have any way of knowing the particular depths of torture that people with OCD go through in these various different ways and content areas. I think there are a lot of myths, and jump in on that if you want, Evie.
I mean, well, just to add to say that it is one of the most debilitating mental health difficulties. I believe that's official and as per the World Health Organization, and in terms of distress, financial costs, and suicidality as well. So it's a very serious issue. Also, because of the shame and stigma and the misunderstanding, like Melissa's talking about, the gross misunderstanding about what it is leads people to not present for treatment or to be misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, and suffering for a lot longer than they should, if anyone should suffer, but that there's that people, there's really not an appreciation, I think, of how debilitating and how much suffering is involved in OCD, and not just for the individual, but also the OCD tends to pull in everyone else around that person. It becomes like a family and relational problem as well. And I think that is also very much ignored, how it impact how OCD impacts the whole system. Melissa, I don't know if that's kind of where you were going, but that feels important to say. It's not just, oh, I'm a little bit OCD. I'm organizing my clothes a lot or something. That's not what it is. That's something else.
And to jump back to the question before about people working in this field, and what you said, Evie, about it being humbling. When I became trained and began to specialize and began to see a lot of people with different varieties of OCD, I could think back about people that I worked with who probably had OCD that I didn't realize they didn't realize was OCD. So it is highly varied, and I think highly disabling as well.
I'm Mario Espinosa-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. As we continue on Central Coast Voices, our guests today are Melissa Mose, licensed marriage and family therapist and the president of OCD Southern California. OCD Southern California is an affiliate of the International OCD Foundation. Evelyn DiMalio Gould, licensed psychologist and board member of OCD SoCal. We've been getting to know our guests a little bit better and hearing about the work that they do in relation to OCD. Thanks for sharing. And I also wanted to invite and welcome our listeners to bring your questions and comments about today's topic to our guests. To do that, email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. In this next section, I'm excited to talk more about the ins and outs of OCD and why it's so important to raise awareness about this topic. And right where we left off, Evie, you mentioned that this is something that brings in people around you, whoever's experiencing OCD. So I wanted to know, Melissa, you kind of pointed to this as well about the role of family in managing and understanding of OCD. You want to elaborate on that?
Sure, I'll start with my own experience and then what I see as a clinician. When my daughter first started asking questions the day she had a pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with strep. So the term PANDAS and PANS are not that well known, but it's a illness that causes a sudden onset of very severe OCD. So one day, your child wakes up and she has OCD and is a different child. So when she started asking me the questions that she was asking me about, had she swallowed plastic? And I'll just give a really specific example because I think the illustration of what it's like is helpful, that she had made cookies the night before where you roll them in plastic wrap and chill them, right? So then she woke up, what if I swallowed plastic? How do you know I didn't swallow plastic? Would I be dead by now if I swallowed plastic? What would happen if I swallowed? Questions that went on for hours and hours, not just three or four questions. So instead of trying to get the information of, do you think I'm okay, mom? She was doing obsessive compulsive loop. And reassurance seeking is one of the compulsions that people don't recognize a lot. The rituals of washing and repeating things are recognizable. But reassurance seeking is a compulsion that a lot of people don't see. And it's very easy as a family member to get sucked in to reassuring and to say, of course you didn't swallow plastic. I mean, you want to calm your loved one, right? So reassurance seeking as a family member or as a friend, as a grandparent, is something that you fall into with really good intentions, and you're trying to help relieve a person's anxiety, but they're not looking for answers, they're looking for reassurance. And that actually ends up making OCD worse over time, because every time somebody does a compulsion, or a family member does the compulsion or helps, it makes the cycle more intense, and it makes OCD worse. And so I think the one thing I want to say to family members and that I see as a clinician is it's very difficult to stop accommodating OCD we all accommodate OCD. It's not bad that we do it. It's good. We do it out of the goodness of our heart because we love our family members who are suffering and we want to help them. But it makes OCD worse. And so not accommodating is the role and that we have to jump into. And sometimes that takes a lot of support. And I try to really support parents. And so Evie and I do similar work supporting parents and family members with that tough job of how do I stay connected and be supportive and loving, but not accommodate the OCD symptoms by contributing to them and getting involved in doing compulsions, washing my own hands to make my family member feel better, for instance.
Yeah,
how do you see that in your work?
Oh, I was just going to add one thing also to what you said, Melissa, because sometimes OCD does appear like in that sudden way. And sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it isn't. It's a gradual slippery slope. And many times I will work with families who are just like, I just woke up and I don't know how I got here. And now our world is extremely small. So maybe it started off with a very, it seems very not doesn't matter kind of small thing just to say, no, you didn't eat plastic, you're fine. But then, you know, very quickly spirals into, and the world gets smaller and smaller to the point where, you know, maybe your loved one's not leaving the house or can't leave the house without hours and hours of you supporting them in all these rituals and avoidance behaviors and things. And it can be kind of like a slow, slippery slide accommodation. But the other piece that Melissa's pointing to is OCD is never satisfied. It's always wanting more and always wanting more. And it's sort of like feeding a tiger. It gets bigger and bigger. And accommodation does the same. It's the same process as ritualizing as well. Like every time you do a ritual, it like reinforces the OCD and sends signals that the OCD is right and I need to keep doing it. And accommodation kind of works the same way. And soon the whole family can get pulled into that. Or, and sometimes we have family members, for example, who maybe one of them is accommodating and the other one may not, or another one may not be doing the same thing. And then we see a lot of distress in the family just from that conflict or from that kind of struggle with what's the right way to support the loved one. I think that's a really common issue. And so it really helps to have the whole family supported where possible so that everybody can kind of get support around this kind of supportive approach that Melissa's pointing to, because the more people that are involved, the more complicated it can get. And it isn't just the OCD. Then there's sort of like this other kind of conflict and distress that can come up as well.
It's also helpful to mention that on the one hand, being aware of the accommodating that we're doing as family members is important. We also don't want to stop all of the sudden once we realize we're making OCD worse, right? So I always make sure to say this to family members when I first explain family accommodation, that if you're washing your hands and you're changing your clothes and you're doing all these things to be helpful, and I sort of enlighten everybody, we sort of do the psychoeducation piece and realize, okay, that's actually contributing to OCD symptomology over the long term. I don't want you to just say, okay, I'm not doing anything anymore, because that we want to balance that out with what the person with OCD is working on, how much they can tolerate. We don't want to pull the rug out from under them all of a sudden. And especially like with what Evie was just saying, if there's one family member who tends to be a little more tough and sort of demanding around, you can do it, just, you know, face your fears. And the other one is more accommodating, you know, can create these schisms in families. And we want to try and do it all in a coordinated way so that family members are pulling back on doing their OCD at the same pace as the individual with OCD. Communication is obviously important.
Yeah, and that kind of leads me to this question about individualized treatment. How important is that I'm imagining very important. Everyone's unique, but I wanted from the clinical perspective that OCD may not be the same case for everyone.
I would say absolutely, and its treatment is important. And I'm also aware that not everybody can access treatment, but ideally you can find somebody who specializes in working with OCD, because even clinicians who don't understand OCD can accommodate, right? So there are a lot of therapists out there who are very lovely and do great work, really great work. And I'm not saying they're not doing good work in other ways, but with OCD, they might inadvertently make it worse. So yeah, finding a therapist who understands OCD and having family members involved as well is important. It's also important to find a community of people. I think that's where the International OCD Foundation is helpful in finding support groups and peer support groups. So individualized treatment is really important. I want to sort of create some hope out there that there's another way as well, if that's not accessible. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to add that I agree that individualized treatment is really important. And it's, I'm thinking like even about especially if you are from a marginalized community of some kind, that it is really important that your holistic approach is important, right? We've got to consider, I'm thinking about clients just to give some examples, say from neurodiverse or queer community who run into issues sometimes when they work with we've worked with providers who've pathologized things that are not a pathology, or they've mistaken certain values or cultural aspects of someone's identity as being part of the OCD when it's not actually part of the OCD, or they might miss something that is OCD because they're not fully understanding the person in front of them as a whole human. So I do think it's important for individualized treatment, ideally from that perspective, the cultural piece, but also just in terms of what we've been hearing about OCD can look really different from person to person. And sometimes that can get missed, or, you know, you do need an individualized treatment plan that works with where you're at in the process and how your OCD is showing up and impacting you and your life. And then of course, working towards we don't want to just do exposures or do this really hard treatment. Sometimes it's very hard. The treatment is not easy. You're asking people to do really difficult things and face really difficult fears. It's like we have to think about what's it in the service of, and that what's this in the service of needs to be individualized to the person, right? That has to be about what that person values, what their deepest values and desires are for themselves and who they are and what they want to work towards. We have to find something very meaningful and very powerful in order to help that person do the really hard things that are going to be necessary in order to get better. So I think it's not just individualized ERP, but also we have to make it the treatment matters, but it matters to you and your particular situation, your life, your culture, your values. And I think that's really critical if you're going to really truly make progress. So finding a therapist who's sensitive to you and your context and is able to tailor the treatment in all of those different ways is really important, and also very hard to find sometimes, right? Sometimes it can take a long time to find the therapist who can do all of those things. So you've got to start somewhere. And I think Melissa pointed to some of the other ways that you could access support and community.
We're going to take a short break to hear from our team, and we'll be right back on Central Coast Voices.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Central Coast Voices today, so we cannot take your phone calls, but we do appreciate you listening and enjoying this program from KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. right now, let's return to Mario Espinoza-Kulik and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Mario.
Thanks, Brad. Welcome back, y'all. Today on Central Coast Voices, we're discussing the realities of obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. Our guests today are Melissa Mose, licensed marriage and family therapist and the president of OCD Southern California. OCD Southern California is an affiliate of the International OCD Foundation. We also have Evelyn DiMalio Gould, licensed psychologist and board member of OCD SoCal. In this next section, I'd like to focus a little bit more on how OCD intersects with other social categories. And I believe, Evie, you were mentioning access in your previous response, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate on any barriers that you might have observed that prevents people from seeking help or accessing treatment for OCD.
Well, I think a lot of them are barriers in general, in terms of access to healthcare more broadly, and particularly mental health or behavioral health care. So I don't think OCD is unique per se in that. For marginalized communities, experience like so many different barriers. And I know it's more your area of expertise, Mario, but for OCD, I mean, access to OCD treatment and evidence-based OCD treatment is difficult in general. There are not a lot of specialists, and then not a lot of specialists also who accept insurance, that are on insurance panels, and also not very few specialists who are on programs or clinics that accept Medicare, Medi-Cal, uninsured individuals. It's very difficult to get care. So those are some of the barriers. And then we have barriers in terms of just assessment and diagnosis, right? We know people of color, autistic individuals, queer community, any marginalized communities, Latinx community, they are much more likely to get misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed, and also diagnoses that get ignored due to other overlapping struggles that are going on or co-occurring issues. There's also plenty of treatment silos, right? If you have a substance use issue and also OCD, it's very difficult to get treatment that supports you around both of those things. Or if you are autistic and also have OCD, there's often silos in treatment and things like that. And then there's just more cultural issues, you know, around stigma with respect to mental health, or different ways that different communities talk about mental health or describe mental health, or how different mental health issues even present, right? How mental health issues look in a white cisgendered community may not be how they look in a Latinx community or another community. And, you know, lack of like training and awareness in the people who are then connecting with those communities in terms of how to recognize mental health challenges is one of the barriers. And then even just having folks that have shared cultural identities with the individuals and the communities we're trying to reach is really limited. So when I look around in our OCD world, we're trying to change this. I think there's a lot more effort in trying to diversify just even who's presenting on, say, even the board of IOCDF, or who's presenting to the community and doing outreach work. And it's not all just white privileged people, highly educated individuals, right? We need to have more representation and more people with knowledge about the communities we're trying to reach, and who can help with those efforts to reach those communities. And there's plenty of other more basic, or not basic, immigration concerns, for example, are another issue that I work with some colleagues of mine who work with the Latinx community. And that's one of the barriers to even getting people through the door of presenting and being willing to come to even a support group, for fear of, are there going to be police there? Or is somebody going to show up and detain me? Or what the concerns are there? And it's not. And then there's the cultural adaptation piece, of course, and it's not good enough to just translate stuff from English into Spanish, for example. Like, that's not cultural adaptation. That's one thing, one piece of adapting treatment. And I think sometimes, well, certainly my observation is sometimes that people are like, done, we translated into Spanish, we're good. And that is really ridiculous. You know, there's many, many layers of barriers. And so even if you manage to get access and have the money to afford a specialist, there's still often barriers in terms of cultural understanding and training and being seen in your whole context and understood and having treatment that's culturally sensitive and adapted to your needs, you know. But I don't think that that's a unique problem to OCD. But we certainly have huge, huge, huge amount of work to do. And I think we have to get more creative and more focused in terms of our efforts and not. I see some barriers just in terms of the outreach that's being done that is coming from a very white supremacist kind of lens of like, this is we're going to have these experts and come out. I mean, look, we're doing it right now to some extent, right? With these experts coming and like talking to people about it, and that's the way to do it. And that's really not how we're going to produce more equity in healthcare in general. Anyway, I'm going to zip my mouth a little.
I completely agree with your perspective, Evie. I mean, especially in thinking about the barrier to language access and the culturally relevant or responsive approaches to care. I mean, it's not enough to just speak the language, but do you understand the cultural nuances, or are familiar with the region that the migrant community might be from? And I think that really is what I've been seeing in the work that I've been doing, is that it matters, and it goes a long way to identify with the person who's receiving treatment, as much as the person who is giving the treatment.
And often I think there are some ways that we haven't really taken, that we're just beginning to try and optimize in terms of reaching and educating people in communities that are not necessarily even therapists. Some more peer support going into the school systems on a really local basis, because I think one of the things that is unique to OCD is that there's less understanding about it. I think there's more training in the field of teacher education about depression and anxiety, ADHD, for instance, even autism a little bit more. And OCD is very new to that field. And so one of the things that Evie and I've talked about extensively is trying to make some little movement into getting into those communities through the educational systems that have more direct contact, so the teachers know what they're looking at, and teachers can perhaps not just label inattention as ADHD when perhaps there's something more obsessive and compulsive going on in somebody's mind that's keeping them from being able to pay attention in class. So I think that education and outreach needs to be focused on that early identification and helping people beyond just the therapeutic community be able to identify it. And I think that's more where we're going to be able to make some impact, I hope. Also, I think letting people know about organizations like the International OCD Foundation, where there are free support groups, there are free resources. OCD SoCal itself puts, runs, free support groups for people who can just tune in, assuming they have the information and the access to join the Zoom, meetings and just get information that's more than what they might have had otherwise. So I think
This, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm done. That's good. Yeah.
I was thinking about what you were saying about peer support and people who have experience with this, and it's making me think about a term I heard from one of my femtors, Shamika, and she had mentioned the term people with lived experience experts. And so I'm wondering if you've seen any sort of terminology like that being used in the in your field, and how that come into play with OCD.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the lived experience community is really a part of the International OCD Foundation. One of the things that I'll say about that organization is that if you are able to go to a conference, what you'll see is all of the communities. You'll see the people with lived experience and the family members sitting and having their coffee before, a workshop with the therapists and the researchers all together. So it's a beautiful way of integrating that. But the lived experience community has developed some great peer support networks and training programs through NAMI, I believe. If I don't know if you know for sure, Evie, but there are they're out there, and these this is a great support system, because it is there's so much shame around OCD, because some of the thoughts that people have are really horrifying to them. And to get in a room with somebody who also has the same kinds of thoughts, or who knows people who have, or who really gets what you're going through, just like with anything else, it's often much easier than walking into a room with a therapist that you don't know, who doesn't identify.
Yeah, there's also, I mean, I guess first thing I want to say, part of the reason why I got into this work actually, and I should have mentioned that, is the fact that it is a level playing field in terms of the importance of including all ways of knowing about OCD, right? Not just an academic, highly educated, research-based way of knowing about OCD, but also lived experience, also families, also individuals, also therapy practice. Like, lots of everyone's in shares the same space, and there are many resources, like Melissa mentioned. And I know social media is pretty evil, but there are fantastic social media resources of people with lived experience really disseminating fantastic information and vulnerability and support around that. And I follow a lot of those people because I learn from them too as a therapist. So in terms of, I haven't actually seen that in other mental health communities that I'm a part of in my work. And I do think the lived experience piece is really important and critical, and is really encouraged. And a lot of actually the well-known therapists who speak at conferences and things also have lived experience, and bring like a very holistic kind of view of what they're talking about, I think.
You're listening to the best of Central Coast Voices on Public Radio, KCBX.
I'm Mario Espinoza-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you recently joined us for today's Central Coast Voices and want to listen to the entire broadcast, you can. It will be available on our website at www.kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you will find this show and many others to choose from. You can also find us by searching Central Coast Voices wherever you get your podcasts. Our guests today are Melissa Mose, licensed marriage and family therapist and the president of OCD Southern California, an international OCD affiliate. Evelyn Damalio Gould, licensed psychologist and board member of OCD SoCal. To keep up with our guests and learn more about upcoming events and programs from OCD SoCal, you can find them online at www.ocdsocal.org or www.iocdf.org and on Facebook at OCD SoCal. As we get towards the end of our show, we still have time for your email questions or comments at voices@kcbx.org. We would love to hear from you. For this final segment, I want to focus on how our listeners can support this work. And one thing that I've been thinking about throughout our conversation is, say somebody just realizes that they or a loved one might be dealing with OCD. What are the first steps that someone like that should take?
Well, I would say get some information, and iocdf.org is a great place to get some information. They also have a treatment directory of people who have been trained to treat OCD in particular. There's all kinds of free streaming programs, lots of education that you can just read or listen to. And it's a great community. So educate yourself would be the first thing that I would suggest, and help and to be comfortable speaking about it. I know that I oftentimes will get calls from parents who will say, "I don't know if I want to mention OCD to my child," right? We really, especially in our community, we really want to destigmatize OCD. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's how your brain works, right? It's okay to say I have OCD and to call it that. And I find that people who begin to understand that that's what's happening, really are almost always, I think I maybe always relieved on some level to know these thoughts are not me, they're OCD. So to be able to speak freely, to get curious, to not assume you know, I think that's the other piece. And to be sensitive to the level at which a person is willing and ready to talk about it. What about you, Evie? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there. And then I would also say, you know, even if your loved one with OCD who's struggling with OCD is not willing or ready to go to treatment and is saying no or saying that we're refusing and not wanting to engage with the information and whatnot, you as a family member or a person who loves that person can still get help and still get support. And actually that can make a big difference in how, you know, what Melissa's been talking about, accommodation and other ways that OCD impacts everybody around the loved person. You getting help will change things and will support you, and you'll be better able to support that person and support them when they're ready to get into treatment. So I think don't lose hope. Even if you're the person you love is really, really stuck, there's still a lot you can do and a lot you can learn and a lot of ways that you can learn to support your loved one, even if they're not ready.
I'll jump on that and say I have helped many kids who I never met by working with their parents. And I think it's a really powerful thing for parents to know, family members, loved ones, partners as well, that our behavior impacts the person with OCD greatly. And so there is hope, even if a person isn't ready for treatment, because it is, like Evie said earlier, it's tough work. It's frightening to think of doing the work that you need to do to heal from OCD.
I wanted to get back to that, actually. Evie, if you wanted to just speak a little bit more about the holistic perspective in terms of OCD and treatment. I know we talked a little bit about that one, but I think how in relation to our community, how can they see themselves as part of holistic care?
Yeah, I think if you can, obviously working with a clinical team or a therapist that views you as more than your OCD is absolutely critical. And then you are more than your OCD, right? You are a whole person. And so I think it's important to be nurturing, like treatment and fighting OCD shouldn't just be about making stuff go away. It needs to be about expansion and about growth and about nurturance and becoming bigger than your OCD and really taking care of nurturing relationships, being in community. I think everything we've said about belonging and finding community and finding people that see you as more than your OCD is really, really important, and getting connected back, reconnected to what matters to you in terms of your values and engaging in life, like really trying to grow what's going to be there when OCD starts to lose its power over you. What do you want to grow? And so I think it isn't just about therapy. It's also about community. It's about getting back into your life and having ideally a treatment provider that sees treatment as that, that it isn't just exposure. It's exposure and life and growth and values work. And also sometimes maybe, you know, making sure that the whole person is being considered there. You aren't just your OCD, and often there may be other co-occurring things that need to be considered and need to be supported, and your family work and all those other pieces. We could probably do a whole show on holistic approaches. And I think again back to the cultural piece, like really nurturing people from a very from the perspective of like there isn't just one way of knowing about a person and about their struggles, and connecting people with different supports that within their culture, right? There isn't just therapy and medical stuff. There's also like other ways that people find care and nurturance and support, and that needs to be respected and thought through as well. So not just connecting again as well in terms of with people who have OCD, but also, you know, if I'm working with a lot, I work a lot with adolescents, but adolescents who are identifying or genderqueer or queer or something, trying to connect them with other young people that have shared identities or have shared interests and other things. So it goes beyond just connecting through the difficulty. It's like connecting and belonging in general. And I think finding joy, like that's really what it's all about, right? How do we find joy amidst all the suffering, and how do I reconnect you with stuff that brings joy to you in really small daily ways, but also bigger, longer, kind of bigger, meaningful ways, if that makes any sense at all. But that's kind of what I think about. So it's not just the whole human, but also treatment being more than just making stuff go away. Treatment being about expansion and joy and meaning.
It's not just symptom reduction.
Yes,
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
yeah.
It's about finding and knowing who you are and what you love and growing
Yeah.
so that, And there's more than just one way to approach that. I think in the OCD
Yes.
community, we do get very focused on symptom reduction because OCD can be so disabling.
Yes,
And
yes.
a lot of times finding that balance where we're helping with those, helping people not become more and more severe in that realm. As Evie says, there are other co-occurring issues that come up, but there's also just how do I know who I am, right? If I'm not my obsessions and the compulsions I do to fix them, what do I like? If I've, we're taught to ignore our thoughts for years, then how do we center, sort of zoom in on knowing who we are and what I want and what's the why for getting better? Yeah.
Have any thing you want to highlight before we end our show today, Evie?
Oh gosh. Well, I think I'll just say the resources again that we mentioned, which is first protocol of the International OCD Foundation, and learning more from there and all the other things that we've said. But I'll throw it over to Melissa while I think about the answer to that question.
Wow. Well, I think that what I, you think of the resources so that I don't have to put part of my brain there. There's hope. There is hope. There is community. There are people with lived experience out there. There are clinicians there. There are free resources. There is hope for people with OCD in a big way. And it's just great to get awareness out there. It's great that people are listening to this program and might get a little bit curious about what differentiates OCD from other disorders. I think that we would love people to get more involved with our organization. We would love for people to come and volunteer and get involved that way. That's another way of really helping and being a part of the solution. Yeah.
How would one get involved in terms of volunteering? Who do they contact?
Go to OCDSoCal, SOCAL.org. We have actually on our website a volunteer questionnaire. So we are collecting information about where people are located, what skills they have, in what way they connect to the community, what they would like to offer. We do events like a speaker series and conferences, and some are online, so people can get, some are local because part of what we do is local, and some is more online. But we're really, we'd love to. We've got a list of volunteers. We reach out. We use our volunteers.
We
We're
have a
trying.
coordinator now. We actually have a person who
So,
can help coordinate Myra.
that's right.
And there's of course all opportunities for you to get involved in a way that's meaningful for you. So if you are a person who says, "I want to start trying to get into schools and help bring awareness," I love that. I'd be like, "Yay, that's what I want to help. Please help us with that." So we're open to ideas. We're open to people who want to get involved, and we try to support people to do things that feel meaningful and appropriate to their skills and drive and values and what they want to do. And it doesn't have to just be what we're already doing. In fact, we're trying to do more than what we're already doing. So, yeah, that's important.
We're looking for advocates, anybody who wants to share their story. I think shared stories also are a really important way of establishing a community that feels like a community. And that's what I hear from people who come to our events, whether they're online or local, that it's so nice to be with people who understand me. And the more those people also share their stories, International OCD Foundation also has a group of advocates. So it's another way of getting involved and being with people who have similar experiences and feeling like, you know, it really, there's belonging there, and that, you know, out of your suffering, you can offer something that may really help someone else. So we're trying to do outreach in as many ways as people can come to us with, be really creative about it.
I want to express my deep gratitude to both of you for shining light on the hope that our communities can continue to maintain and look towards a future that is inclusive and also accessible for folks that are in need of treatment, but also just safe for everyone to live and be themselves. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mario. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us today and everything you all do in our communities. Our guests today have been Melissa Mose, licensed marriage and family therapist and the president of OCD Southern California. OCD Southern California is an affiliate of the International OCD Foundation. And Evelyn Damalio Gold, licensed psychologist and board member of OCD SoCal. We hope you'll join us next time on Central Coast Voices for our show on Thursday, April 11th at 1 p.m. Join host Fred Monroe as he speaks with guest Jim D'Antona, CEO and president of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and Rachel Wallen, workforce development coordinator with the SLO Chamber. They will discuss how the SOAR, Slow Onboarding Assistance Resources Program, is designed to make it easier for employers to recruit and retain employees by taking a broader approach to community connection and support. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. We also depend on listener support, so please consider making a donation today or become a member with your monthly donation online at www.kcbx.org. I'm your host, Mario Espinosa Kulik, and thank you for joining us today.